Dan, listen.
And Steely, when you get this one, this is no recarnation. This is an upfront article, Dan. This is not special, not a sample. This is an example that no one can get unless and then can consult them Bible. Original front teeth, gold teeth, Dan Gargan talk. See? Come in, old boy.
J'ai souvent pris la route pour aller nulle part, sous un ciel étoilé, un nouveau départ, pour rencontrer ce one que je pourrais aimer. Oh yeah. Elle est là devant moi, on croise nos regards, un sourire et un aïe, je n'ose pas y croire. Ne me demande pas pourquoi, mais je l'ai trouvé. Oh yeah. You wanna be my lady? Honey, chérie, honey. You wanna be my lady? Do you know you drive me crazy? Yeah. I can get enough. There is no way to come undone. Honey, chérie, honey. You and I will be so easy. Yeah. The sky, the starry night, everything will be alright. I want it,
honey, sherry, honey, honey.
I love it,
honey, sherry, honey, honey.
Inside me.
that record was written. You know, it's just it all clicks together.
Thank you. You're listening to Radical Scotland on Repeater Radio. That was Dawson with Process Purpose Vacuum Pack. And our special guest tonight is Ger Reid from Dawson, one of the best Glasgow bands ever. Absolutely ferocious and inventive punk band. They were part of a whole great scene in the early 90s with Stretch Heads, Dogface Hermans, Badge Wearer, Archbishop Kebab and so on. Since then, Ger's been involved in all kinds of projects, including working with Dance and Glasgow Improvisers Orchestra. So we're absolutely delighted to have him here on Radical Scotland, talking about the Glasgow Music Collective, the politics of around DIY and underground music, and the beauty of collaboration and community. And following our discussion, we're going to have a mix by Ger and our resident turntable genius, Mariam Razai. I'm your host, Stuart Smith. This is Radical Scotland with Ger Reid.
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs out in Bearsden, which, you know, was always involved a lot of ribbing from the punk rockers, because we were the, I mean, rightfully enough, we were the suburban kids, but I always feel like I always was standing up for my mum and the fact that she was a single parent bringing up five kids and holding down a job, so it wasn't masses of money and blah blah blah. I guess it starts really with I went to school with Ali Begbie, who's in Dawson, and I play with him still in some shapes and Painted Dextry, and yeah, we used to walk home from school when we were 10 together, so I take the piss out of him because I always say he was the latecomer because I was at that school from when I was 5. He didn't arrive until he was 10. But so, yeah, I mean, music, I was thinking about this, there's so much to say, and it's, I don't know about you, but it was really interesting from the age of like 10 to 14 how much different music I was into, like different kinds of pop music and then some soul music and then you know, big country stuff like that, and then rapidly into sort of The Cure and New Order and Joy Division and all that. But in the space of about 3 years, I went from, you know, being into Blondie to being into sort of The Temptations and Martha Reeves, and then into Joy Division and The Cure. And so the first music that me and Ali played, well, here's the story, is that I got a guitar when I was 14. I bought a guitar and tried to learn for about 6 months. Kind of got nowhere, got really bored with trying to play House of the Rising Sun. and eventually I kind of put it to one side, and then Ali, around that time, got a drum machine and a guitar himself. And I'd basically kind of given up on it. But then I used to go around to his, go to his front room. I guess we were 15, and just drum machine and distortion pedals and guitars. And like, you know, we were both rubbish, both couldn't play at all. But obviously it just didn't matter. And it was kind of like, if he could play two chords and I could play two chords, then there was a few variables that we could put together. So that was, yeah, we'd just make a racket. In fact, there was flangers involved as well, not just distortion. so we would just make a racket in his front room, and then a wee bit later at school, we started a covers band and was, yeah, playing Joy Division and Birthday Party and all that.
Oh, that explains the flanger.
Totally. And yeah, and there wasn't, and that didn't last so long, I don't think. I remember we played a gig in the school, and then quite quickly, I think after that, we wanted to start writing songs. And so the singer in that band was Ian Baird, who's manager of the Craig Tannock, or are the Craig Tannock venues in Glasgow. Okay. So I've known Ian since then. We used to hang out when we were teenagers, and now he's he runs Stereo and Mono and Flying Duck and all that. So Ian didn't keep going, but the guy that played drums was a guy called Graham Thompson. Tom and me and Ali just started to write stuff. And Tom is and was really fascinating. I was thinking about this as well. Like, I was thinking about that thing of wanting to make music to dance to and where it came from, because because most, I mean, I wonder if it's that dance music was almost coming through sort of New Order and all that stuff. Well, the other thing that was really interesting was that around that time was the start of hip hop, and Ali especially was really into it. So that's a really interesting component of it, is actually we weren't really into soul music. Tom was really into James Brown, and stuff. He was really into James Brown, and which brought a really nice funkiness to the start that I don't think me and Ali would necessarily have had. But hip hop was a big thing, and I remember Tom getting the first Public Enemy LP, and just being totally blown away by it. Just really like we'd had those Street Sounds LPs, you know, the Electro Records. We had a couple of them, and that was all like Dougie Fresh and Fat Boys and all that, and we were really into that. But going from that to Public Enemy was just like whoa, just such a harder sound. And so anyway, I was thinking about that today. I was thinking about how, even though it was noisy guitar music, and to me or to us, maybe it was always music to dance to as well. So that was Dawson. Really interesting. We rehearsed in a place that was run by the manager of Wet 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 in Maryhill. And we always used to laugh because every single time he came in the room to check something with the PA, he would mention something about Wet 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 when none of us were at all interested. I don't know how we found out about the other studios. We might have just been looking for other studios and saw that there was this place in Park Circus and just tried it out. I think that's how it went. I don't think anyone gets a tip off or anything like that. And that was Tower Studios that Craig Tannock and Callum McLean started. And we hilariously were known as the band we would go and rehearse for 1 hour. The songs were so short that was like we could run through the songs twice and, you know, start writing a new song in an hour. And that was incredible to actually. Craig Tannock actually recorded and mixed our first demo tape that we did in 1988, I think, incredible guy and incredible. I remember so clearly just the conversation being really unmusical, and we were incredibly unmusical, and it was really just like, just describing sounds and having fun describing sounds with somebody to try and get an idea of how you wanted the overall thing to sound. It was just such good fortune to meet him, to meet someone that was like that good-natured and hilarious and unpretentious about music. And really supportive as well, actually. Mm-hmm. Really, really, really supported us. And he actually, I was saying to you before that, it was really hard to find places to play gigs. And we put on a couple of gigs. Well, actually, the first gig we played actually was upstairs at 46 West George Street, which I've missed that part of the story, actually, which was... Before Dawson started playing, we were going to Splash One happenings that were happening in, I think it was 85 and 86. I was trying to look it up. I don't know if it went later than that, but we would basically, Splash One would happen, was a nightclub run by Bobby Gillespie. I never knew if Stephen Pastel was involved with the running of it, but I know Bobby Gillespie definitely was. And it's one of those things you could actually get into a place when you weren't 18. You could, you know, you didn't need ID. The bouncers would just kind of be like, what age are you? And if you said 18, you know what I mean? Or they would just say, what's your date of birth? And if you could remember your date of birth, it checked out to be 18, then you would get in. But that was a really formative influence. So we would go to Splash One. We were still at school and we'd go to Splash One on Sunday, and sometimes walk home and get home at 4 in the morning and then get up and go to school on the Monday. And the bands that were at Splash One, we got to see like Sonic Youth and Firehose. So, yeah, so in a way, I think we were into Firehose before we were even into the Minutemen, actually. I think they found out about Firehose first. So yeah, we got to see Sonic Youth and Firehose, and 23 Skidoo played as well, which was totally incredible. And they were moving, they were less in their funk stage, and they were more into, they were also into electro and hip-hop stuff, but it was totally, totally brilliant. And famously, Jesus and Mary Chain played there when their first single had just come out. And so before they were like playing the Barras and there was riots and stuff, they played this like 46 West, I think it was called Daddy Warbucks before, or I can't remember the name of it. I think it was Daddy Warbucks at that point. But anyway, it's Jesus and Mary Chain played and to like a 300 capacity place or whatever it is. And the bass amp blew up and... basically, so that's, you know, the Jesus and Mary Chain without the bass amp, it's just basically feedback and shouting, which was a really amazing show. So yeah, it was really hard to find places to play back then, and Craig Tannock was one of the people who started to find places and gave us an opportunity to play. Like, folk don't know that Craig Tannock scoped out what became King Tut's Wawa Hut. That was just a boozer that had a back room, like a really big function suite. And Craig started putting on gigs there, and then DF saw that it was a really cool space and bought the whole place up. But so Craig gave us some of those early gigs. We played a band called Capone and the Bullets, who I think are still going. They're like a ska band, and then we got to play with Teenage Fan Club with John Peel DJing. That was a later gig that Craig did. That's just to say that Craig recorded our first demo and was really supportive, and that was really great fortune to meet him. And then I suppose the next part of the story was that we also recorded our first single at Tower. And but with Callum, so that's when I started doing the record label as well, basically, which was called Gruffwit Records. Mm-hmm. It still is, actually. Still, the Some Shapes record came out on Gruffwit and other labels as well. And I want to do more with it. But so that's when I started the record label, sent it to John Peel. Actually, we'd already been played on Radio Scotland by Peter Easton, the mighty Peter Easton on Beat Patrol, and I think John Kavanagh played us as well. But so I do remember the first time we were played on Radio Scotland, but then I also remember being in a bedsit in the West End and picking up the phone, and John Peel was at the end of the phone.
Wow.
He was just like, got your single, I'm into it. I'm going to play it tonight. And then we arranged to do sessions. And it's, you know, a lot of people know this, and maybe some people don't know it, but I'll just, almost a cliche, but just to go through it, this, the importance of Peel at that time is just, you know, I mean, it just can't be overstated. Not just the thing of getting played on the radio and doing it. I mean, doing a Peel session was like the, you know, for like punk rockers to get paid BBC rates to go and play a Peel session, but basically would fund you to do a tour that was going to lose money. Do you know what I mean? Because we were playing small gigs and not getting guarantees or any of that stuff. So there's that. There's the money of doing a Peel session, but then there's also the fact that people would get in contact. You would read out your address, and people would get in contact. And other bands would get in contact with you. So a really famous one for me actually was, God Is My Co-Pilot from New York. Mm. John Peel played God Is My Co-Pilot. That's what it was. And I sent off to buy their CD. And then they said, oh, we're hoping to come to Europe to do a Peel session on some gigs. And I set up some gigs for them. Glasgow and Edinburgh and maybe Stirling. And then they became some of my great pals, and I've played in God Is My Co-Pilot when they came to Europe, and myself and Craig had a band called Pope Joan, which was in about 19 94 or 5 that had Caroline Crabble in it. And
saxophone player, yeah.
Saxophone player, yeah, who weaves in and out of the story quite a lot. So, and Jason Boyce, who was in Dandelion Adventure.
Scene in John Robb's book Death to Trad Rock, gives you a really good history of that kind of post-punk thing. So I guess that's the context for a lot of the stuff you're talking about here. A lot of bands are playing on Peel, and there was a big Scottish contingent of kind of noisy, weird punk bands, sort of Edinburgh side of things, the Dogface Hermans. But then Glasgow had Dawson, Stretchheads, a few other bands, and you're all kind of hooked up with other bands around the UK. And there seemed to be a lot of collaboration and touring and support for each other.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That is a great place. And also the John Robb book also is crucial for us because it played it talks about the Ron Johnson Records bands and Big Flame especially were just like a sort of massive influence. I mean, kind of like, I want to say pretty much all. Only conscious influence I probably had when I started playing guitar was to, you know, when I started playing guitar in Dawson anyway, was to try and sound like Greg O'Keefe from Big Flame.
So it's idea to crank the treble and
back pickup only, treble at full. Yeah. So you're right, that's, you know, a lot of those people were connected, and even people like John Robb's own Membranes were already connected to the Pastels, and Pastels were connected with, yeah, and Ajay Sagar from Dandelion Adventure, he was really connected with the Membranes. But yeah, and I've actually got a list of, well, maybe that's a bit later, but the other bands that were around in Glasgow at the time were Badge Wearer, Whirling Pig Dervish, who were both bands that I put out on Gruffwit, and Stretchheads were really pally with Dog-Faced Hermans, and then we got pally with the Stretchheads, and then got pally with the Dog-Faced Hermans, and actually the first time Dawson went to Europe in 1991, the Dog-Faced Hermans organised those gigs, and we went and they played the gigs. Around that time, we started the Glasgow Music Collective as well, which initially had, it was kind of inspired because there was an Edinburgh Musicians Collective that had rehearsal studios and stuff, I think, that Dogface Hermans were involved with. And so we had all these sort of highfalutin ideas of what we would do. And the Glasgow Music Collective pretty much just ended up just putting on gigs. That was all we did. We talked a lot about trying to get sort of collective studio spaces together and everything, but it didn't happen. I wanted to get a wee name check of the people who started the Glasgow Music Collective, which was me and a woman called Joyce Monaghan, who was in a band called We Are the Men. They're crucial in that it was such a blokey scene. There was some women that played music, but it was so blokey. But We Are the Men were, you know, it was all women, and, you know, by design, do you know what I mean? We're like, we're gonna make a band that's all women, and kind of challenge a lot of the blokey kind of, yeah, blokey, muso kind of attitudes to play in. Mm. And I don't know if they were into the Raincoats and bands like that, but there's definitely a kinship and mm. and really, yeah, really strong attitude. Mm-hmm. So they were really important, I think. So Joyce from We Are the Men, a guy called Jim Kavanagh who ran Egg Records. And Egg Records put out more kind of tuneful, you know, C86, that the cassette, if folks don't know, that was the cassette that NME put out in 1986 that had a crossover of more sort of tuneful guitar bands like McCarthy and Closed Lobsters and bands like that, and then slightly noisier stuff on Ron Johnson Records like A Witness and Big Flame. So Jim Kavanagh did Egg Records, which was a bit more like the tuneful kind of sort of, you know, yeah, that kind of slightly also sort of quite militantly anti-rock music, which is brilliant. And there's a lot of those bands like the McCarthy who went on to be Stereo Lab and all that I really loved. But anyway, Jim, the funny thing about Jim Kavanagh and Egg Records is that one of the bands he put out was called Remember Fun, which turns out to be Raymond McDonald. Yeah. And me and Raymond, like, literally 30 years later had done a duo show and we're having a beer in the bar afterwards and chatting about playing in bands back in the day, and we hadn't realised that I certainly hadn't realised that Raymond had been in Remember Fun and that we'd been like, you know, 2 degrees of separation away from each other. Which is hilarious. I was just finishing up the first group of people that were involved with the Glasgow Music Collective, which was Joyce Martin from We Are the Men, Jim Kavanagh from Egg Records, Angus McPhee, who is in a band called Glue, and was inspirational in lots of ways. He was a wee bit older than us, and he had like proper DIY spirit of like making his own records and making his own t-shirts, booking his own tours. Anyway, so Angus, we were the three main. I think Sandy Blair from a band called the Poison Sisters, if you've heard of them. I think he was also in that first iteration, but definitely me, Joyce, Jim and Angus. And so if we're talking about looping around, and the Music Collective put on a bunch of gigs. It went from 1990 to 98, I think, put on lots of different stuff. But crucially, I'd say maybe two of the crucial bands that we put on was the Honkies, which was also Caroline Crabble.
Yeah.
And Richard Harrison drumming, Andy Diagram playing the trumpet, and Kathy Hume, actually, who has been played at, I think, 2 Counterflows ago. I can't remember the name of the group she was in with Robin, but...
The Hairdressers.
Yeah, I knew something like that. Yeah, yeah, that exactly.
Was
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So Kathy was in the Honkies. John Edwards joined that band actually later on. So that's when I first started to know John in the early 90s. And I was looking at the old Music Collective poster stuff. I'll send you a link to a page that's got a bunch of flyers actually, which is interesting. Because I think it's, I mean, I love how music's so, how people are so diverse and eclectic in their tastes now with music. I think that's one of the things with the internet, isn't it? It's people can access different stuff and they make connections between stuff. And I think it's much less tribal. It used to be really tribal. So although it's not, doesn't seem like a big deal, we would put the Honkies on with like some kind of hardcore band or kind of Discord Records band. And, you know, people were definitely open-minded enough to get into it. But I think it was quite rare in those days. And fair play to the Honkies. They were, you know, they were totally up for it, of bringing free jazz to noisy guitar audiences, you know. The Honkies was a really crucial one. And just to say, that was the other side, that there was the kind of anarcho-punk thing. Mm-hmm. The anarcho-punk thing was, we had a lot of friends in that world as well. Bands like Disaffect and Sedition, especially, and a bunch of others. Vomit Head was a band played as well. But and then Sedition became Scatha a bit later on. But so they were all, those folks were also coming to see gigs that had like Honky's free jazz stuff, and those folks were not listening to free jazz at home. Do you know what I mean? They were listening to noisy guitar stuff. The Honkies was a really important band, and they played quite a few times for the Music Collective. And then the X was a important band. Obviously, the first time they came to Scotland, we organised a bunch of gigs in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Stirling, Perth.
The Boys Brigade Hut in Stirling.
Oh yeah, were you at? You were.
Which
at
I was blows. No, I was 11. So. I love that building because it's has an amazing motto on the front.
What does it say?
Under the eave, and it's a quarrelling is taboo. absolutely love that. But it blows my mind to think the X played there and because the X have every gig they've ever done listed on their website, which is really interesting. So that's how I found out about that.
And they famously, the X, they started off with Terry, and it was Luke that was playing the bass on that tour. And the first song, there was like doors at either side of the stage. There was like a few stairs that went up to the small stage with doors either side. And the first song, Cat counted it in, and they opened the doors and came out like a like a cuckoo clock. one on either side of the stage. That was quite hilarious.
Wow.
That was, yeah. So the first time the X played in Glasgow, and Andy Moore from Dogface Sermons was playing in that configuration. Yeah, it was a formative moment. Not just that the music was totally incredible and the energy was through the roof and the politics was amazing and they were super friendly, nice, hilarious folks. But also just the culture they came from, that coming from a sort of deep culture, deep Scot culture in the Netherlands. We just didn't have that in Scotland. We've never had that in the same way that London had it around that time. And Manchester's had more of it, and I think Leeds has had a bit more of it. But yeah, Scotland's just not had that. And to meet people who came from such a different culture of daily life, do you know what I mean? Rather than just daily life being, I don't know, like the... It's that thing, isn't it? We're talking about space again. It's just like if you don't have space that allows you to define the culture outside of the mainstream culture, it's really hard. And they came from a world where there was space and there was collective, non-private space that was sort of politicized. And to get to go and see that was just like, totally opened our eyes to different ways of living as well as not just different ways of thinking. The other important thing about the X was the musical influences as well. The guy selling merchandise on that first X tour is a guy called Gert. Do you know Gert? He wrote a book called Not for Rent, which I think you'd be really interested in, which is it's kind of counterculture stuff in the UK. Written with a woman called Stacey Wakefield and Gert.
Oh, okay.
And there was it was sort of covering road protests but also music stuff. The One in 12 Club in Bradford, which was which is still open and was like a massive, in the UK was the closest thing we had to something like a social, like a European social center. Mm. 1 in 12 club was in Bradford. Yeah, it was a place that we played a lot. Dawson played a lot and every, and all the bands afterwards have played a lot. Mm. And it was, yeah, it was an anarchist run social center. Why the hell is I talking about that?
The X.
Well, I can't remember how I got it. Thank you very much. Yeah. So I'm not sure. Still don't know how I got to 1 in 12. But anyway, Gert was the guy who was doing the merch for the X that came that tour. And he became a really brilliant friend. And he ended up doing the live sound when Dogface Sermons moved to Amsterdam. He ended up doing the sound for them. Mm. That's why I got to the 1 in 12, because okay. Gert's book, Not For Rent, covered the 1 in 12. So that's what that was.
Okay.
Yeah, so Gert became a really brilliant friend, and the X, obviously, they've always been really into folk music from all over. At that point, they were getting really into Hungarian folk music,
mm.
and they did like a cover of a Musicas mm-hmm. tune, and the Dawson folks had always been into different kinds of folk music as well. We used to have a wee distro that we took when we did gigs that had, like, you know, hardcore punk records and kind of Ron Johnson-y records and then like Bulgarian folk music and Hungarian folk music, and especially Bulgarian and Hungarian folk, because folks from those countries didn't have any currency to buy records, so you mm. quite often get letters from folk wanting Gruffwit stuff and not having any cash, so the only thing they could offer in return was folk music, but the records were totally amazing. Hungarian dance house compilations and yeah, mm. kind of more obscure Bulgarian folk music, which is some of it's like, you know, really nice and gritty.
Yeah. So I got a few I picked up in the Stirling Oxam a couple of years ago.
Okay.
That's the Musicas album. Right. There's a couple other on Hungaraton, which really? I guess is like the state label.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's a hardy-gurdy music. It's great.
Okay.
It's just like... Cool. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And that's it. It's relentless, isn't it?
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. And then it was also interesting because it was there was so much chat about Scottish folk culture then. It was kind of interesting. Obviously, I'm not massively knowledgeable about Hungary at all, but there was just that huge folk revival that happened. And even though a lot of the stuff was sanctioned and came through the state record label, I mean, like I say, I'm not knowledgeable, but it seemed to be like the folk culture was really blossoming and being supported. Not to say that that's straightforward. I don't know how it ties in with notions of Hungarian nationalism or whatever, but still just from on a musical, you know, interfacing via the music, it seemed like really cool and really kind of vibrant. So so Gert, who now runs Red Wig Records, who put out King Aisoba and loads of sort of post-punk stuff and everything. It's a brilliant label. At this point, I wanted to mention that there's a tape that Gert made for me, copied for me, of Moorish music from Mauritania, which is Khalifa Ould Ide and Dimi Mint Abba. And what's interesting is that Dimi Mint Abba is the stepmom of Noura Mint Somali that played at Counterflaws. And I really wanted to play a bit of that because that was a tape. It's just a nice example of a tape that Gert made me in 1991 or 92. That I listened to death, and then it comes around again, and it's sort of like connects to Counterflows and stuff. Thank you. Important thing around that time was that the X started getting into improvising.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They did the first record they did from the BIM house, the jazz place in Amsterdam.
Yeah,
I think it was 1991, I think.
Oh, okay.
And it's another loop around because there's a track. I'd love to play a track off of that. And a lot, and some of the players that are on there were playing in the ICP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Han Benink, of course, was involved, and Walter Weirboss, people like that. And again, it's a nice loop around because years later, ICP came and played with the Glasgow Improvisers Orchestra. Mm-hmm. After seeing Han Benink play in the X and in other configurations in the ICP, I actually got to kind of share a stage with him and Walter Weirboss and people like that. So the X were, for all those reasons, X were just so important, like, a kind of door into a culture, and then the improvising and the folk culture stuff.